Spatulon.
Spatulon.
What's the 56th installment of this series? At this rate, it seems like it's going to take us forever to get through this. But remember, we're just looking at the words of Yehovah in the First Testament. So once we get past the Torah, especially, it'll go a lot quicker. But then after that, I don't know, I was kind of thinking about it. I'm kind of early to be thinking about it. But then it's still going to be a while.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll do a series on the, maybe on the prophets or the writings or something. Who knows? We'll see where the Lord leads us. Mm-hmm. I may just return to my typical subject-oriented messages, which I enjoy. At any rate, I don't know about you, but I'm learning things going through this, and it's causing me to have to deep dive into some of these things, and I learned some things this week, too, so I'll share those, and maybe they won't be new to some of you, but they were to me. So anyway, we do find ourselves this week beginning in Exodus chapter 34. And we see Yehovah giving this command to Moshe. And the Lord said to Moshe, "Cut two tablets of stone like the first ones, and I will write on these tablets the words that were on the first tablets, that which you broke. So be ready in the morning and come up to the mountain, to Mount Sinai. Come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. And no man shall come up with you, and let no man be seen throughout all the mountain. Let neither flocks nor herds feed before that mountain." We know why, right? Because we understand that's being represented then as the Holy of Holies up there. Okay. So he cut two tablets of stone, Moshe did, like the first ones. And then Moshe rose early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him. And he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. So God is going to write, or should I say rewrite, the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, on these new stones that Moshe is going to take up there. Of course, he smashed them when he came down, and we learned that that was basically he was angry at what he saw, but he didn't throw them down because he was angry. He threw them down ceremoniously because that was a basically a Middle Eastern custom. When you break the covenant, you break that which with which the covenant was written. So that was a ceremonial thing that meant something to the Israelites when he threw those down and broke them. So of course Moshe obeys this command of Yehovah's, and he went up alone with the new tablets. Yehovah shows up. And then we're going to read these next few verses. And I want you to pay real close attention to these, because they're very important for a number of reasons, and we're going to discuss this today. Verse 5, starting there. "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord." So he said his name. "And the Lord passed before him. And he proclaimed, 'The Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering, abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation.'" Now, as discussed last week, at the end of the previous chapter, chapter 33, we get a glimpse of what's going to happen here, that Moshe had asked to see God's glory, and God was willing to grant that request to a degree, right? So the answer to the question then of just where this occurred, right, and where Moshe would stand, and where Yehovah would reveal his glory, is revealed here. So remember here that the summit of Mount Sinai is is where the rock would have been, the cleft of the rock that he hid behind. And we're on top of the holy mountain. This is where God came and revealed himself. Because remember, these chapter breaks are man-made. So this is, you know, you're kind of just flowing in the story here. So he kind of says what's going to happen, and then he just gives more detail just right away later. So the chapter breaks don't mean anything. And things are not always in the Bible in a Greek sequential order. So we're getting more revelation here of what happened. So I want to take a deep dive into what occurred here. And you know, whether you believe that this happened twice or once doesn't really matter. It happened. So we need to understand what happened here in verses 6 and 7. Because Yehovah is proclaiming not only his name to Moshe, but also his character. And that's really important. See, with the first advent of Yeshua for us, you know, these things are not a revelation, are they? We can almost take these for granted. Anyone that has attended a church in our day and age, or even a synagogue, has been taught about Yehovah's love and his mercy and his grace and his patience and all of these attributes of his. But these few verses are so important and so central that they actually have become like a central part of every Hebrew religion, all the Jewish sects. It's a central part of it. They're actually known as the 13 attributes of God. So Yehovah tells Moshe that his very essence, who he is mercy and love and patience and faithfulness and all these things. And that he is loyal to those that are loyal to him, that he sets apart. And he clearly states here that he's going to be loyal to thousands of generations. And you need to understand this. That is a Hebrew that statement there, the thousands of generations, it's a reference to forever. In other words, there is no limit to his mercy. To him saying, I will have mercy for thousands. He's saying, I will have mercy forever to those. You know, we sing a song a lot of times in the churches of God, from 1 Corinthians, Chronicles rather, chapter 16. We sing that we give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His mercy endures forever. That's a reference to this idiom, okay? Now, this idiom means forever. So that can be confusing, can't it? Because we read in verse 7 then that it says his justice, right? He's visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Huh. So he says that his justice demands that he cannot call the guilty innocent. And that justice will affect multiple generations down to the fourth generation. So it even says because he visits, he's actually causing that to happen. It's because he's issuing whatever result of that sin or consequence, it is going to have an effect on those generations, right? So third and fourth generations are way less than 1,000, aren't they? And way less than forever. So what gives here? How is he saying that I'm going to have mercy for thousands of generations, which is an idiom for forever, but yet the iniquity is going to be visited on 3 to 4 generations. We need to understand, again, Hebrew culture. In that day, extended families did not depart the way that we do. We have what's called a nuclear family. And that's what we call a man and wife and their children. The children grew up and they leave the house. That did, that does not occur, did not occur in the Hebrew culture. The family was a unit, and the family grew, okay? It was very typical that, you know, you had this whole household, that you had the great-grandparents and the grandparents and the parents and the children all living together, one family unit, many times working the same type of business or vocation. And you still see evidence of that today in Israel. While I was visiting there, I noticed in this really old part of town, you know, these buildings, and they're very squared off. And a lot of times you'll see, you know, the main floor, and then you can tell this was built at a different time, and then this was built at a different time. And you see that over and over again. And I asked Moshe, you know, what's the deal? And he said, well, it's indicative of the Hebrew culture. Still alive at that time. You know, mom and dad built a house. And then when the kids grew up, well, they didn't go anywhere. So they just build on top. Right? And then their kids would grow up and they'd build on top again. And so you can even look in the architecture of the old Israel and see 3 to 4 generations living in the same house even. And so that was just carried forward from the way that it was that Yehovah is referring to here. Each, you know, this is the way it was for everyone. You know, as the patriarchs would die off, you know, then the next level would just come down, you know, and you had 3 or 4 generations living together. So we don't do that. But when you understand this, when you have to realize that if say the great grandparent had some sort of grievous sin, now he is there mercy for him? Of course. But is there consequences? Absolutely. And if you're all living in the same little tent city, if you will, or structure or whatever, doing life together, the same vocation, whatever, the sins of one is going to affect the entire family. And so this is what happens, right? You know, somebody sins, gets disciplined for it, and it affects everybody, not just the one. So then, knowing that what those two Hebrew idioms are based on, right, that's based on their cultural practices, what Yehovah then says here makes a lot more sense. It's in no way contradictory then. He is contrasting that the Lord will show kindness forever, mercy to thousands, to those that love and obey him, but will cause consequences for a person's sin. He will cause those consequences, right? A lot of times those consequences he caused them by the way that he created the universe, cause and effect. He doesn't have to actually intervene. He's already put all of those things in motion. So those consequences then will visit that family, that person, to 3 upwards of 4 generations, right? So it is for a relatively short time. And that became yet another Hebrew idiom. So this mercy to thousands really was an idiom for forever. And to the 3rd and 4th generation became an idiom for a short period of time. A relatively short period of time. Okay? That make sense? Yeah? All right. I want to bring out something else here, something that has really come out really in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, and that's with the revelation of his name that he proclaimed to Moshe clearly. And it goes hand in hand with a major principle of Christian faith, and that is that there are only 2 ways that we can know who the invisible God is. How do we know who the invisible God is? Now, we know there's an invisible God because we see evidence of it all around us. But who is he? Okay? And that is by his name and by his characteristics. Those two things. So notice here that God gives us several characteristics or attributes. And then he also clearly associates those things with his name. He pronounces his own name, Yehovah, and with that, his characteristics. Now, obviously, this is not an exhaustive list of everything that God is. But this is a list that is designed to create relationship, so that we know who we're in a relationship with and how we can expect him to treat us and have that interaction. And so really, do we need more than that? I mean, he's kind of given us enough for a relationship. And today there is like this ongoing debate about, there's just multiple paths to God. We have a lot of people arguing that the Muslim Allah is the same God as the Christian God, or is the same God as Yehovah. And when you look into that, you really look at it, Allah can't possibly be Yehovah. Why? Because, first of all, I mean, we kind of know that in our heart, right? But how do you support that? Well, first, you would have to say that they don't have the same name. Okay? Yehovah is not the same as Allah. In fact, Allah is really, that goes back 4,000 years prior to Yeshua, clear back to Nimrod, of multiple pagan gods. Okay? So just by the name alone, you can't get there. Okay, so because Yehovah pronounced his name and also his characteristics are the other thing that uniquely identify him as God. When you look at the Quran and you dive into it, you talk to a Muslim, and I don't want to offend anybody, but you talk to a Muslim and they will tell you that God, Allah, their God, is all of these things. That he is merciful and he's just and he's all these things. But when you read the Quran and you see the commands that Allah gives to his adherents, he's not. Those characteristics do not bear out in action. So they don't have the same characteristics. So this is why Yehovah very specifically tied his name to his characteristics, right? You know, they will even say that Yehovah itself is just translated from Arabic to Allah. And it's, don't fall for that, it's utter nonsense. Again, Allah has always been associated with the moon god, okay? So, you know, back when we did the World Watch thing, we looked very closely at all, not all, but a lot of those pagan religions that were all about the moon and the crescent and all of that. That all ties together. So if I ask you if neither the name or the characteristics are the same, it's kind of ludicrous to think that they're the same God. And so, guys, this is why we pay so close attention. You know, people will say, you know, you're trying to earn salvation, you're trying to works or whatever. But guys, this is why we pay so attention to the Sabbath, to the holy days, to the festivals, to all of these things, these appointed times, and his name, and all of these things that God reveals about himself. And he reveals to us to do in alignment with him, because that is the relationship part of it, okay? When we do these things, we're not earning any salvation, we're not doing all that. What we're doing is we're putting ourselves in a position like Moshe. Moshe had to stand up and walk up that mountain. He had to do what God told him to do. And when he did, he got in his presence. And had he not done that, he wouldn't have been in his presence. And none of this about him would have been revealed to him. And that's why we do these things. We do them so that we can come into alignment with God, so that we can walk according to what God said, and then we can be in his presence. And as we're in his presence and we abide in his presence and we walk in his presence, we can learn about him. We can grow in that relationship. And we avoid then the consequences of mixing truth with men's traditions and men's philosophies and all of those things. Right? Because we don't want to do that. We don't want to sacrifice the, you know, what did they do? They compromised at the bottom of that mountain, and they said, well, God said this, but over here we know how to do this. Well, we'll just compromise and we'll kind of mix the two together. That mixture, that's what God does not like. And so, particularly in our day and age right now, we have got, you know, we have got this call across our globe right now for tolerance and peace at any price, right? So I want to go back to these two verses again, 6 and 7. And when we look at some key words here in the original Hebrew, I want to substitute some Hebrew words that you guys are now familiar with for their English in verse 6. Because this is how literally the verse would read for us. I am Yehovah passed before him and proclaimed. I am Yehovah. El is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding, and so forth. What I'm trying to demonstrate to you is that for several traditional reasons, a lot of things I won't go into, the English translations do not actually say the name of God, do they? They don't. Rather, when God's name, Yehovah, is actually written in the original, the translators write God or Lord. Understand something. God and Lord are not names. They're not names. In our society, even, we deal with names and titles as two separate things, don't we? If I call you Mr., it's not your name. Or Mrs., it's not your name. Doctor, lawyer, right? Whatever. It's not a name. It's a title. Okay? And Becky's a name. Jerry's a name. Scott's a name. Whatever. King is not a name. President is not a name. They're impersonal titles. And therefore, when God pronounced his name, it was a very personal thing to Moshe. It started to create the relationship. What's the first thing we do when we meet somebody? Hi, what's your name? Automatic. It's the first thing you say. So, I want you to notice here that when he gave him his name, he actually said, Yehovah El. I want you to notice that word El. It's pretty interesting, it is to me, because El is a title. It's a title. And that title was a title, it was a word used like president or king or anything else in society across multiple even languages, and used throughout the pagan kingdoms. And what it refers to is the preeminent God. In other words, You can be God in those pagan religions, but if you're El, you are the God above all the other gods. See, they were a multiple God religious system. So El was the God above them all. That's why in the Bible you read a lot of times, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, these kind of things. That's all from El. That's what it's talking about. So he's saying here, literally, he's saying, I am Yehovah. Yehovah, God of all gods. That's what he's declaring to him. I am gracious, I am merciful, I am compassionate, and so on. He's revealing himself to Moshe, not only in form, but also in name, and also in character. And so, I'll also remind you, in some Bibles, you're going to see Jehovah, the J, sometimes. Now understand, even in those translations, some of those translations you might see Jehovah four or five times, maybe upwards of 15 times in some of them. But do you know how many times his name, Yehovah, is actually in the Bible, in the original Testament? It's over 6,000 times. 6,000 times. And it's just ignored and missed. As we don't, you know, the forces don't want us to know our God like he revealed himself. God didn't just do this out of the blue. This was in response to what we read last week when Moshe said, show me your ways and show me your glory. And that's what he's doing. He stated his name. He stated he is above all gods, El. And he described his character at the same time that he showed his form. Okay, let's move on. Let's look at these next two verses. So Moshe made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. Well, wouldn't you? Hopefully. Then he said, if I have now found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go among us. He's asking him to come back and be in their presence. Because you see, that was, he, even though he is for will eventually now forgive them, he had removed his presence from them. Right? And so now Moshe is saying, come on, be back in my presence. Even though we are a stiff-necked people, pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us as your inheritance. So, right after God, you know, just pronounced his name and his attributes and passed before him, Moshe uses this moment to appeal to God to restore the broken relationship with Israel. And you need to pay attention to this too, because this is the model. This is what each and every one of us are to follow on an ongoing basis. Because notice what he does. He falls on his face before Yehovah. He made haste and bowed his head toward the earth. He fell on his face. He agrees with Yehovah's assessment of the situation. We're stiff-necked. We sinned against you. And then what's he do? He pleads for restoration. And there, right there, is the model for each and every one of us of how to approach our great God, Yehovah, when we know we have committed an offense against him. We have to realize that the offense is sin and that it is against him. We have to confess that sin and agree with him that it is sin. And then we have to ask then for restoration. Now, for us, the fact is that restoration, that forgiveness, is somewhat automatic. You know, I mean, Yeshua has already paid for all sin, even sin that hasn't even been committed yet. But that does not mean that we are not still to go to Yehovah every day and confess our sins to Him. I mean, we all do sin still, right? So that is the pattern. The nice thing is, with Yeshua, we don't have to worry about an answer. We don't have to fret about an answer. We don't have to wonder, well, did He forgive me or not? You know, okay. You got to realize that back then they had a lot of dread and fear over this. Because if they sinned, they had to go and bring a sacrifice. And those, you know, and the sacrifices were supposed to be from the best. Well, what if my best wasn't good enough? What if the priest that did it that day messed up and he wasn't really clean when he did it? Or what if I didn't do it soon enough? What if? Right? So they had a lot of anxiety. You know, am I forgiven or not? Well, we don't have that. Because we have the surety that Yeshua's sacrifice is more than sufficient for everything. If we are faithful to just come and say, yep, help me to get over this. Right? Okay? So we are in a much, much better position. Thanks to Yeshua. Okay, here's another thing to realize. I kind of already touched on this, but I want to make a real point about it. God is forgiving Israel in this because He is restoring the covenant. He's going to rewrite the plates, and there's forgiveness here, and He's going to restore the relationship. But it's a while. You notice that He does not yet come and dwell with them. His presence is still not with them. And He doesn't start calling them My people yet. So there is this bit of discipline, okay, as a good father, you know. If a child does something wrong, I mean, you know, we love our children. Forgiveness is like automatic, right? I mean, you're just, okay, they're a kid, right? I get it. But that doesn't mean you withhold the discipline, does it? See, and for them, the discipline was, you know, you're not going to have yet My presence with you. You finally get it later, but you get the point. That there was an intimacy that God wanted to have with Israel that was lost. I mean, it was always there. Yehovah was always offering it, even on the mountain when he was on the mountain and he was thundering down to him. He was wanting to tell everything that He was telling to Moshe. He was wanting to tell to everybody. It was only when the people said, no, 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 we're afraid, Moshe, you go. Right? So He wanted that connection with them all. But they refused it. Right? And then when they did the golden calf, and they, you know, basically committed adultery with Him, then there was further separation. So we need to understand that these modern doctrines that Christians can sin without consequence because of the sacrifice of Yeshua is not correct. It is wrong-minded. There's no scriptural backing for that, even in the front or back of the book. Guys, forgiveness is forgiveness, and it's there. But consequences are consequences, and one does not necessarily terminate the other one. Okay, and so as we examine our walk with God, and we sin, we're going to sin, and then we ask for forgiveness, and then we're still experiencing the pain of our sin. We cannot equate that to say, well, I guess God didn't forgive me because He didn't take the consequence away. It doesn't work that way. And so it can be a stumbling block if you don't understand that. Make sense? Okay. In verse 10, God then reinstates the covenant. He said, I make a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among you who are shall see the work of the Lord. For it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. So, again, even though Yehovah agrees to establish the covenant, he makes it clear in this part here that's coming up that there's two major conditions for Israel to obey. We see it first in verses 11 through 16 that they must not mix themselves with the Canaanites and the otherites. Okay? They must not go back into idolatry. And second, verses 17 through 26, there are several God-ordained observances, appointed times, feasts, different things that they're also always to keep. And I want to review them. 11 through 17 first. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you all the ites. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you're going, lest it be a snare in your midst. I'm having to hurry. But you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images, for you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant, a treaty, an agreement with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. You shall make no molded gods for yourselves. So this is the first major condition of this covenant. You're in covenant with me, Yehovah says. Don't cheat on me. That's the phraseology you would use right now. Don't step out on me and worship other gods. Don't worship me like they worship them. Don't take their sons and daughters into your life and be influenced by them. Right? He's going to give them explicit instructions. He's going to go in there and wipe them out so that that doesn't happen. Okay? Yehovah is dead serious, guys, about not worshiping him in any way that the pagans did. We've covered this, but it bears repeating. Now, the second condition is a common sense thing, goes right along with this, right? He just said, this is what you're not to do. This is how you're not to worship me. This is how you're not to be influenced to worship me. Now let me tell you what you should do. Let's read that part. The feast of unleavened bread you shall keep. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you in the appointed time of the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. All that opened the womb are mine. And every male firstborn among your livestock, whether ox or sheep. But the firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem him, then you shall break his neck, if I can't have him killed. All the firstborns of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work. But on the seventh day you shall rest. And it doesn't matter when, doesn't matter how busy you are, no matter what's going on, in plowing time and in harvest, you shall rest, and you shall observe the Feast of Weeks, of the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at year's end. 3 times in the year, all your men shall appear before the Lord God of Israel. For I will, and if you do this, I will, cast out the nations before you and enlarge your borders. Neither will any man covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God 3 times in the year. Leave your house and leave the doors unlocked because it don't matter. God's going to take care of it. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, nor shall the sacrifice of the Feast of Passover be left until morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. So, in a nutshell, what do we have here? It's, don't worship me that way, worship me this way. He's restating the Sabbath. He's restating the holy days, showing how we are to honor him with our time. There's also a number of reminders of how we're to honor him with our resources. Guys, this is the same covenant as before. So the Bible doesn't go through everything all again, but isn't it interesting the things that God inspired the Bible to restate when this covenant is redone? Do you think they're important for a relationship with our great God? Of course they are. It's all about not worshiping one way, but rather with the things that God ordains. It's the same format as before. If you will do these things, then my presence will be with you, and I will do these things. Okay? It's a covenant. It's a two-way thing. But it says, I'm gonna go over there, and I'm going to drive out all those ites. If you do this, but don't you dare make another covenant. Don't make a treaty. Don't make an agreement with these people. Israel is to have covenant only with Yehovah. He even tells them when he goes over there, we read it, that they're to destroy their altars, destroy their standing stones. Those were memorials made to different gods, to destroy their tree poles. We would call that a totem. They were idols. They're destroy all of that. Okay? In Hebrew, that is an Asherah, okay? Or an Asherim in the plural. And it comes from this word Asherah and Ashtoreth, and also Astarte. And then later, you'll recognize this one, Ishbar. It's all the same thing, okay? It goes all the way back there. It is the fertility god of pagan religions, okay? And you realize that whenever Israel fell into idolatry, it was either that moon god that we talked about already, or this fertility goddess. That's because those were consistent gods through the pagan religions, and they were very common. They were the dominant ones, all right? And so they never, in their minds, ever turned their back on God, on Yehovah. They just added in. Oh, well, we'll just cover our bases, right? Or we'll take these things that everybody else is doing, sound familiar, and we'll use those to, you know, to worship the true God, which is exactly what he said not to do. If you are in a marriage, do you get in another marriage? Do you make another covenant with someone else? Do you bring another person into the marriage? It's an abomination. And that's why God calls it that. He calls it that. It's interestingly ironic to me that much of the church has no problem shaming ancient Israel for their idol worship. And yet they don't take the time to understand that Easter and bunnies and rabbits are a celebration of a fertility goddess. And so in one way they're like, oh yeah, those Israelites, you know, they committed that idolatry. And yet it just has flowed right down to our modern times, and we're still doing it. You know, we all guilty one time or another. So listen, this is why I researched and researched and researched, and I've covered this at length over the years about these practices and their origin. Because Yehovah clearly tells us how detrimental it is to our relationship with him. It's critical It's not Salvitic in that sense, sort of, but it's fundamental in a relationship with him. It's playing the harlot. It's adultery. It's an abomination. His words, not mine. And they had just done this with the golden calf, and he's saying to them, look, I'm doing this again. Don't you do it again. Don't do it again. In verse 15, here Yehovah says to Israel that if you do make a covenant, if you do make a treaty or anything with those living there, you're going to go down a slippery slope. We're going to have trouble pretty quick. And we see later that this happens, you know. Joshua and others doing precisely what God said not to do. They went in there, and rather than wiping them out the way God said to do, they made peace treaties with them. You know, they went after what their natural minds would say. Okay, you know, look, God says go in and wipe these people out. You get there, and you know, and they're people, and they're children, and they're, you know, women, and you know, the king seems really nice. He'll work with us, right? And there's all these people there, and they're willing to pay taxes to us. So what's wrong with a little extra cash? And surely God will forgive us because we're being merciful, and God says he's merciful. So we're just following his character. Do you see how easy it is? We are masters of justification. We are so good at it. And if God is not right there in your, and his presence in your life, you can lose focus on what he says. You see how easy that is to do? No, that's how all the other nations did it. Well, how can so many people be wrong? You know, every other conquering nation, they go into other nations and they get them to pay taxes, or they get them to make them, you know, servants or whatever. Why shouldn't we get to do the same thing? Why not? Because God said so. And that's the difference. When God uses that word, El, you know what he's saying? He's saying, I am sovereign. I'm not just God. I am God above all gods. I am over everything. And you don't have to understand what I tell you. Just do it. You know, this whole thing of going in there and saying, okay, well, we'll acquiesce and we'll let that king keep going, and we'll keep taxes or whatever. We'll make these arrangements. You know, that's why we have the problem in the Middle East right now. Because if they'd have done what they said they were supposed to do, we wouldn't have this problem right now. At all. And so, if there was ever a call to God's people to be uncompromising, this chapter, we're reading it. This is it. And I'm going to say this. Yehovah is not a God of religious tolerance. Do you hear me? Now, I'm speaking in contrary to everything that this society is telling us right now. It's about as against it as against the discourse as possible. It's diametrically opposite. Yehovah is not a God of compromise and consensus. Yehovah does not honor our sincerity or our earthly definition of love when they go above his commands. We read in verse 14 that he's a jealous God and that he won't tolerate the worship of a false God. He just told his people not to mix themselves with pagans. But it's inevitable that people want to have good relationships. We want to get along, right? But unfortunately, you know, we We can't have that in Satan's world. We can't have it. You know, Yehovah uses very strong language here, and unfortunately, the Bible translators have diluted that because they don't think it might, you know, hurt somebody's feelings. But Yehovah calls this act of accepting pagan gods or worship as whoring. Whoring. But that's an ugly word. We know what it means. It's an ugly word. And God knows what it means too. And so our culture has come to this point of division that basically says every person on this earth is in one of two classes. You are either tolerant or you're hate-filled. You're tolerant or hateful, one or the other. If you're not one, you got to be the other. And if you're not tolerant in every single thing, then you are over here. Well, God's people are not to be tolerant of some things, are we? Are we to be tolerant of abortion? Tolerant of homosexuality? No. And you know, you gotta draw that line. Why? Why can I say that? Because Yehovah is not tolerant of it either. Those things that I just talked about, he calls abominations. We're not to bow down to the wishes and custom of pagans. We're not to join in their holidays. We're not to tolerate sin with anyone, with each other. You're not to tolerate my sin. So that is balanced. I mean, if somebody wants to get on my case and say, well, he just said, you know, tolerate all those people because they're sin. Like, I'm above that. No, I'm not, because I sin too. But I'm not asking you to tolerate my sin either. So our response is not hatred, is it? Or violence. We shouldn't go out of our way to create strife and upheaval. We're to be light, not a sword. We're to be gentle, not mean-spirited. But guys, the only light that we have is the light of Yeshua and the teachings and the instructions that were given. And so that's why we're to take this out and be gentle with it. I mean, what happens if we begin to tolerate or accept or respect the adversary? It all breaks down. It all breaks down. We're going to have to learn to stand firm and realize that peace with God is not the same as peace with this world. In fact, in our current condition, they're opposites. And like Israel had to do in their settling of the promised land, they had to choose one or the other. Not compromise. And of course they compromise. He just laid it out. He said, don't do the things that way. Do them this way. I am El. I am Yehovah El. To me, that's the big message here. Yehovah says, worship me my way and only my way. If you're going to be in covenant with me, you've got to honor that covenant explicitly. With no compromises, no agreements with anyone else that conflicts with my covenant. Or he says you're a whore. You're a whore. You're whoring around. And if you're whoring around, my presence isn't going to be with you. God will not tolerate evil mixed with goodness, period. I've said this a few weeks ago. Unity is not going to come from tolerance or compromise. God creates that unity. He's going to create a unified, peaceful kingdom by dividing those that will or will not be subject to His sovereignty, who will not accept Him as El. Okay. figure out how much of this I'm going to do. Because I'm running out of time. I want to address this. The last part of verse 26 says that you're not to boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And it's right in that same section. And we think, well, that's random. Where in the world did that come from? You know, here we're talking about, you know, these two sections, you know, don't do it this way, but do it this way. And then we get this bookend at the end of it. Oh yeah, don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. What's he talking about? Do you realize it's this simple? Back in the day, all of those pagan religions, right? That was one of their major ceremonial practices. It was nothing more than a pagan religious practice of a sacrifice to pagan gods. And so God just, he says, don't do this, do it this way. And then he gives an example of, again, what did he just bookended it. It's that simple. But you know how much, commentary there is about this stuff? You know, back to don't make stuff up, right? And think about this. God said, you know, don't add to or take away from the words of this book. Do you know how many regulations there are in all of these different Jewish sects about that command? You cannot sit down and serve dairy products of any kind with meat. And you have to, it says, don't boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And they take that, whoo, blow it up to, you can't even sit down and have a glass of milk and a cheeseburger.
You got cheese on the burger.
Cheese on the burger.
Or, you can't even have a cheeseburger. Right. Right. So,
and different plates for different things.
Different plates for different things, even different utensils. If you use the utensil on one, you use it on the other. So have they added to? Of course. And you think about, it says don't take away from. Well, what have we done in the major Christian religions is we've completely ignored the command altogether. And if you ignore it altogether, you miss the point. And what's the point? The point is, everything we just covered, don't worship me this way, do worship me this way, is if they hadn't missed the point, they wouldn't be celebrating Easter and hunting, you know, colored eggs on a sunrise service. See? There's consequences. Don't add to, don't take away. All right. I am out of time, so I'm going to just ask you guys this. I can go through the last few verses, won't take too awful long, and go over, or we can stop right here and I'll address them next week. What do you think?
Go over. Up to you.
Go over.
Go over.
Okay. All right. We'll just cover this real quick. Verses 29 to 35, and then we'll be able to finish this chapter. Now it was so, when Moshe came down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moshe's hand when he came down from the mountain, that Moshe did not know that the skin of his face shone when he talked with him. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moshe, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moshe called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him, and Moshe talked with them. Afterward, all the children of Israel came near, and he gave them as commandments all that the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai, much more than what we talked about. He was up there another 40 days and 40 nights or whatever. And when Moshe had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But whenever Moshe went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out, and he would come out and speak to the children of Israel whenever, whatever he had been commanded. And whenever the children of Israel saw the face of Moshe, that the skin of Moshe's face shone, then Moshe would put the veil on his face again until he went in to speak with him. So there's a mixture here, and we're seeing this again, of Moshe being in that tent that we talked about last time, and also being on the mountain. There's a mixture of that in this. So Moshe spent these 40 days up there. It was another 40 days. And We're told in a number of places, including directly from Moshe's mouth, that sometime in the future, a prophet like Moshe would come to Israel. And that prophet, of course, we know, turned out to be Yeshua himself. And there's a lot of these parallels between the two. And then the light is what struck me with this. That, you know, Moshe was the mediator between God and Israel. Yeshua is now our mediator between us and the Father. Moshe was actually above the high priest when he was there. And Yeshua, obviously, has an office higher than the high priest. Yeshua spent 40 days in the wilderness. Moshe spent 40 days in the wilderness, basically, on top of that mountain. You know, Yehovah gave the tablets of stone to physical Israel, and they were to physically, you know, understand these and try to write them on their minds and obey them. And but yet Yeshua came, and we're going to get to that here in Pentecost. It's going to provide His Spirit to actually spiritually write those laws on our heart. So there's a lot of these things that are parallels, but also there's this light, right? Moshe was the reflection, the light of God onto Israel. And in the same way, Yeshua says, "I am the light." You know, He came to reflect God to physical man. So there was a lot of these parallels. But what strikes you too is that the people made Moshe put this veil over his face because that scared them. They didn't want to see it. And it really makes you think, do people really want to see God's light? Do they really want to hear His voice? I know we'd all say, yes, we want to do that. There isn't a believer that wouldn't say that. But I know in my heart, my honest choice for many years, and I suspect some of you were or are, in the same boat to some degree with some aspect of our life, that it's just better to hear about God. It's really good. It's really nice and it's comforting to hear about God. To be told about His voice, about His light. But when we see that light, do we run from it? Do we want to hide from it? When we hear that voice, when we hear these words in His Word, do we shrink back from them? Do we really want this relationship? Because the Israelites didn't. They continually did this. They continually shrunk back. They wanted to hear about God from the mediator, but they didn't want to get too close. And I'm afraid that's what we see so much today. It prevails today. There's very serious Christians out there that have only been told about God. Shorthand doctrines, bumper sticker theology, song lyrics. Just like the Israelites wanted to know about Him, they want to hear the stories, what God has done for them. The story of Jesus and His salvation. But knowing about God is not the same as knowing Yehovah El. And the very words of this chapter in Yehovah, I think, clearly illustrate that point. That we need to be willing to not only know about Him, but to know Him. And to engage with Him in purity. Not playing the harlot. Not going in opposition to Him in the manner, you know, other than the manner and in the ways that He says and He prescribes to do things. Staying within the guardrails of His instructions. Meeting with Him when He says to meet with Him. Listen. This is not me telling you this. It's not me saying this stuff. You and me, all of us, have to individually, deeply think about these things that we've covered here the last couple of weeks. And what transpired at the bottom of that mountain in the hearts and minds of those people, and how they responded, and really examine ourselves and how we're responding. Do we want to know about God? Or do we want to know Him? You know? We need to understand the ramifications of this. That when we sin, we've got to acknowledge it as sin. We need to get into agreement with God that it is sin. And we've got to ask forgiveness. That model, that pattern that we saw. And then with that forgiveness, we've got to apply ourselves to remove the things that are in opposition to God, get in agreement with Him, and focus our lives and focus our hearts and our minds, our time and our resources on the things that He said. And we've got to remove the attitudes and the practices of a Satan-inspired society and embrace life the way that Yehovah outlines for us. And so to me, in a nutshell, that's the lesson here. That's what I got out of it. And I'm interested to circle up and see what you all think. Amen?
Amen. Amen.